Welcome to the UK's only weekly FM radio show on transportation. I'm Mark Ovenden. Today we're talking about an invention with major links to the island, but which has also helped to move millions across the channel. It's a form of transport that often gets overlooked, but was revolutionary when services began. We are celebrating the hovercraft, and with us to discuss it is someone who is also known for his work on other vehicles, especially those in the movies. He's also written the leading history of the hovercraft. Ashley Hollybone, welcome to the Catchcast.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Now, we've come to ride today to be within sight, just about, of the UK's last remaining hovercraft service. And we are going to discuss that as we go along. But I seem to ask all my guests on the show a very similar starting question. How did you first get interested in your specialist subject?
I don't know really how to explain it, but I've always been interested in space and weird and wonderful vehicles, and hover cars always interested me. And then when I was at school, I started to build a hovercraft just out of old lorry inner tubes and things like that. And then when I was about 15 or 16, I went on the SRM4 hovercraft over to Calais. Amazing experience. That got me hooked. And then by accident, I found a derelict US Coast Guard hovercraft, which was rotting away. Yeah, I ended up buying it. Then I bought a crash-damaged Microlite because it had no engine in it. I used the Rotax 503 engine from the Microlite in the hovercraft and made up a frame for it and got that going. I lived on a council estate in Twickenham, and the police came round my house because I started it up in the street, because all the neighbours complained they didn't like me because I made so much noise.
Now, I've got to go back a step there. You found a hovercraft. How the heck did you do that? Where was it?
I think it was on a farm in Surrey, and I was just out on my bike and I came across a hovercraft called a Starbreeze RX2000. It looked like an F-16 fighter jet, and it was just derelict. And I ended up, I don't know how I bought it, but I did buy it. Yeah, and I sort of resurrected that, got that going. Then I took it to the military vehicle show at Beltring, War and Peace. Then I got asked to leave there because I thought it was a good idea to start it up and take it around the arena. As I was going down the little aisles, I looked behind me. I couldn't hear anything because it's as noisy as a helicopter when it gets going. I looked behind me and it was like a scene from The Wizard of Oz. There were these tents and people chasing after me with sausages on sticks and women shouting at me because they put their babies to sleep. And I got asked to leave by the organisers.
It didn't put you off anyway?
No, it didn't put me off. I was still playing around and sketching hover cars and things like that and looking at the legalities. I did ask the DVLA what happens if I make a hover car, and they said, well, it's not in contact with the road, so therefore it doesn't come under their jurisdiction. Anyway, it was a bit of a grey area. I didn't pursue it. I did make models and various things and designs, but yeah.
And did you take any of those interests into your career, your first jobs?
Yes, I had that hovercraft, and then I got asked to be in an Oasis music video, and I turned up on set with this thing, and it was so noisy, so loud, kicked up so much dust, it knocked over cameras and lighting equipment, and I got asked to leave again. I was working in the film industry when I was about 8 or 9, doing sort of acting as a child, so I sort of fell into doing vehicles on films, aircraft and boats, and mainly cars really. But the hovercraft was a big interest in me, just because it looked so space-aged and sort of weird really.
So you started in the film industry quite young as a child, and did you immediately start showing them your strange props and vehicles?
I was probably more interested in a Spitfire or a hovercraft or a 1929 Bentley than I was acting. That was my stumbling point, I suppose, for being an actor. But I was more interested in having a good time, really, I suppose. I mean, driving a hovercraft is like driving a car on ice without any steering or brakes, certainly the smaller ones anyway, not the big ones. They're very interesting to drive, put it that way, yeah.
Very slippery.
Yeah.
Tell us about some of the recent vehicles that you have made for the movies without giving too many plots away.
I've always been in the film industry. I think I've worked on every Bond film since GoldenEye in one way or another. The most memorable film that I've worked on was Masters of the Air. And for those that don't know, it was about the American 8th Air Force. It was a continuation from Band of Brothers. But for that, the team that I was involved with, we had to build replicas of B-17 bombers. We made 2 full-size ones that were able to taxi under their own steam, BGI, at Long Cross, and Neil Corbould and Cayman Bourne were responsible for that, and I worked with them. And one of the things I was really responsible for was a certain rig, which was based on a Leyland 8x8 ex-army drops unit. We had the nose cone, the whole nose section of a B-17 on the front of it that we'd made, a BGI had made. And so we wound the pump up on this truck and it would do 65, probably 70 miles per hour down the runway with an 8-ton hydraulic pack on. I know it sounds all mystical the way I'm talking, but you never really get to see these big rigs, because when you watch the film you just see the actors doing what they have to do, but it's the engineering that goes behind things like that that you don't really get to see. And after the film most of them just gets thrown in the bin, which is a shame.
You haven't managed to bring many home here to ride?
No, not really, no.
So Bond films,
yeah.
Harry Potter, Lara Croft, Mission Impossible, Bridget Jones, Edge of Tomorrow. Tell us about any of those vehicles you made for those.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just making them. I can say, like, on the last Bond film where we had, I think it was 16 Toyota Land Cruisers. Now, on the face of it, a Toyota Land Cruiser doesn't sound a very exciting vehicle, but it was the most reliable vehicle that I've ever looked after on a film. I had to buy 16 of them for the film. And in the film, you only ever see one, Daniel Craig's driving it. But I think the lowest mileage one I bought was about 300,000 miles. And that is the one that's in the museum at the moment. We didn't have to make them, but we just had to make 16 look identical. And then, going to the other extreme where I work with a team of people and then they build cars that are remotely driven from the roof. We call them pod cars. So the actor sits inside and for all intents and purposes, the car is surrounded with lights and cameras and they do their high speed action. And then there's a stunt driver, for example, Mark Higgins, more than a stunt driver, I should say, but he will sit on the top of the roof in a pod, what we call. And the car is remotely driven from that over 100 miles per hour. Everyone is perfectly safe. It's tested for months and months and months in advance, way over engineered for obvious reasons. So the actors are completely safe. That's part of our job, is that we have to make sure everyone is safe before we put it out on set. So all of these weird and wonderful things are over engineered for a certain reason, but built and tested before they, you know, go onto the screen.
Now, you're based here in Ryde. You're currently, I suppose, a freelancer, is that correct? But you do quite a lot of work for Netflix.
Yeah, I do a lot of work for them. And I'm also developing my own films and projects that I'm working on there, in the process of co-producing a couple of films. So I believe there is going to be a new independent film industry eventually. The American film industry obviously will still thrive, but I do think there's potential for a new independent film industry so that there's not long gaps in the output of content. Everyone is employed, and I think there's going to be a new scope for new, slightly lower budget films. So I'm in development for a couple of films, one about the Falklands, one about Concord. Things that interest me, things that I think that have never really been touched on before. So yeah, I'm sort of in the realms of setting up something along those lines at the moment. Yeah.
Wow, this is fascinating stuff. Have you ever thought of suggesting a hover type vehicle of any kind to any films?
I would love to suggest let's make a hover car, obviously. But at the same time, I do think there's potential for a wing in ground effect. So for those that don't know, a wing in ground effect, it's almost like a hovercraft with wings. Completely space age looking vehicle. It's a combination of a ship and a bomber, really. The Russians really excelled with those in the 1960s and 70s. And today, the winging ground effect, WIG for short, is being capitalised in the commercial markets for passenger service. It's not put out there in the mainstream yet. It's a very, very simple process. If you ever see a swan or a seagull coming in to sweep low over the sea, you'll see it glide for a long period of time. It doesn't flap its wings. That's in ground effect. And that bird is taking the most of a natural form and creating lift. And I've always thought, well, why can't we use a small winging ground effect in a film for a stunt sequence? They fly below radar, so they can go as fast as you like. They can be chased and not seen on radar. They can go over land, they can go over water, and they can land on land. So in my mind, I've got this great stunt chase sequence, but it's just in my mind.
One day it could happen.
You never know, yeah, one day.
And see everyone's hair get blown off underneath the downdraft.
Yeah.
Let's talk about all those equally fabulous floating fancies. How on earth did they come about? When was the idea of a hovering craft first mooted?
You could really look back to it. So 1716, a Swedish inventor, Emanuel Swedenborg, created a design for a concept that was intended to reduce the drag on the undersurface of the hull. His design never really was built into a working prototype. It essentially looked like an upturned boat hull, so there was a trapped air segment underneath, air pocket, but it was never produced. So that was kind of one of the first steps to reducing drag of a boat hull. And then after that, in about 1865, John Scott Russell adapted a small clinker-built boat with a hand-operated bellows, which would essentially pump air underneath the bottom of the hull and create bubbles. That would help to make the hull less sticky in the water, and everything is about reducing friction. So a combination of air being forced under the hull and a combination of air being trapped under the hull. So this was 200 years ago. People were thinking that way. How can we make a boat travel faster in the water with that notion of using trapped air underneath the hull? The most notable point after that came in the mid-Victorian period when John Thornycroft, a name that is well familiar in high-speed boats, in the early 1870s, he again adapted another small boat hull with forced air underneath it. But this time, rather than just forcing bubbles underneath the air, he actually devised a system where he could captivate the air with segmented pockets of air. That was really one of the first pioneering early steps. There was this system now where you were looking at air underneath the hull, where it was trying to stay there as long as possible. That's what the inventors were trying to do, keep the air underneath the hull as long as possible, reducing friction. So people were thinking this way for a long time.
Now, I think there was an Austrian chap who built something called a Luftkiss Englight boot. Do you know about that?
Yeah. So that particular vessel, I mean, that must have looked so futuristic compared to the ironclad dreadnoughts of the day. It took the profile of an aerofoil wing shape. It acted a little bit like a hydrofoil. It used aerodynamic principle. This was in 1916, so it was incredibly advanced. But it wasn't a hovercraft, it wasn't amphibious. Its propeller shafts, its propellers had to remain in contact with the water. But its actual hull shape resembled the cross-section of an aerofoil section of a wing. So as it propelled itself through the water, it would eventually, up to a certain speed, create lift through the aerodynamic profile. That would then force air underneath the hull, reduce the friction. It was a motor torpedo boat, essentially. Most of it was made out of wood. It was very, very fast in its day. It must have looked so futuristic. It was another step closer towards the development of getting people to think about the hovercraft.
Now, you mentioned flying cars when we first started speaking. What was the Ford Motor Company doing, experimenting with various different flying cars and things?
You have to look at the 1950s to see what was going on in America. America really were so pioneering. Most of the major motor manufacturers were producing all sorts of weird concepts for flying cars, hover cars. This isn't a question about technology, it's more about the design that looks so radical that it inspires people to think, wow, I want to see what the next Ford Thunderbird is going to be like, for example. You have to imagine that in this period, while most of the world was still absorbed in the jet age, America was going into the space age. So children were growing up watching the Jetsons, and in 10 years' time, potentially, most Americans believed they could be living on the moon. So the crescendo of the development of the fins of the Cadillac, ending in the 1959, the Eldorado Cadillac, wow, this is space age. And most people had gone through the Second World War, had come back. Obviously, hot rods were a big thing. The hover car was like, wow, this is what we want to do. But like I said, it was the space age. It wasn't jet age, it was the space age. And the hover car was something that everyone potentially could have. Ford were inventing that and pioneering with different concepts, as well as General Motors and lots of the others, really.
So in a way, it was kind of more of a marketing concept than anything they actually made. But in that mix of things, along came a British inventor by the name of Christopher Cockerell. What was his role in things?
Christopher Cockerell was what I would say a backshed inventor. Most innovation in this country comes from men and women in their backsheds making things. Christopher Cockerell used to work for Marconi. He lived in Norfolk and he ran a boat company. So the two crossed over. He wanted to make boats more efficient. And in his spare time, he used to overthink things. And he became the father of the hovercraft, really. Essentially, he adapted what was called the plenum chamber to make forced air underneath the hull of a boat stay there as long as possible so that you can create lift in a usable way. He just really used an old coffee tin and a hairdryer. He proved his concept with that, and then he produced several working models. He tested the working models, which I have to say it looked incredibly... This is in the 1950s, so these models look like UFOs. They were incredibly space-aged as models. He tested them at local cricket fields and stately homes, clean-cut grass.
Am I right in saying he took that idea to our government and they didn't really know what to do with it? So what happened next?
Yeah, so he went to the Air Ministry. The Air Ministry said, no, it's a boat. We don't really need that. He went to the Admiralty and the Admiralty said, it's an aircraft. We don't really see much potential for that. And then, by chance and by a bit of perseverance, he was introduced to Viscount Lord Louis Mountbatten. And it was Mountbatten, really, that pioneered the hovercraft in so many ways. Mountbatten was able to help him secure funding through a new government initiative that helped develop the hovercraft from just a working model into the first prototype.
And that happened at a company called Saunders Row.
Yes, so Saunders Row in Cowes had a background in making very successful seaplanes, also unorthodox aircraft as well. So they were kind of the perfect company to be commissioned to make a prototype of this weird looking vehicle. Their location was also fabulous. They were in very sheltered water, so they had nice calm water to test it. Here on the island we have lots of smooth long beaches where if you get into a problem you can beach it, but also for testing and development. So the Isle of Wight, because of Saunders Row, became the epicenter for the development of the hovercraft, and it was the SRN1 that proved to be that.
Talk to us, can you, about how this incredible machine was first brought into public passenger service?
Yes, again, it was under development still. So to put it into public service, it was put into trials. So the first scheduled passenger service was the VA-3, the Vickers Armstrong 3. Vickers Armstrong had a history in building all sorts of military vehicles and obviously aircraft. So this particular one, which compared to slightly later ones, looked very unorthodox. A bit of a mess, really, in some ways. It weighed 10 tonnes. It was the first scheduled service, and it ran in July 1962 on the Dee Estuary in North Wales to the banks of the Wirral. It was powered by a gas turbine engine, and in that period of time, most gas turbine engines on hovercraft were adapted from helicopters, so they're sort of marine converted. The service wasn't a success, and it wasn't necessarily due to the failure of the hovercraft, it was the weather. The weather really, really affected the development trials. It broke free of its mooring in a storm and did a lot of damage to it. It was just unfortunate, really. You can never really 100% predict the weather, certainly in the 1960s. The weather really put a dampener on that. But it was the first hovercraft service. After the VA-3, the one that was most notable was here on the island, which was the SRN-2. This was a world away, if you like, from the VA-3 in the way that it looked. It was very smooth, very aerodynamic. That hovercraft was a success. It also was trialled in Canada, and again, was just trying to drum up enthusiasm, really, for the hovercraft to try and take pre-orders, a bit like how Concorde travelled the world to try and gain pre-orders with that. The SRN-2 kind of cemented an idea for a crossing from the mainland to the Isle of Wight. It went from Portsmouth and it landed in Apley Beach in Ryde. And it was a success. Again, it looked space age. People wanted to travel on it because it just looked out of this world. It would cross the Solent the fastest anything had done before. It would just go from beach to beach. And then from the SRN-2, the crossing from the Solent, developed into the SRN-5, and it was powered by a Rolls-Royce Gnome gas turbine engine, which was a version of the same engine that was used on the Sea King helicopter. The Gnome engine was used in lots of helicopters, but it was kind of a proven engine. It's very small, so it's kind of easy to work on, and on the SRN-5 it's easy to get to. That particular hovercraft evolved into the SRN-6, which is essentially a lengthened version of that. But one thing is probably a little fact. On its first year of a scheduled hovercraft service, there were 8,384 Solent crossings scheduled in 1967, and only 2% of those were cancelled, mostly due to bad weather. There would have been the odd mechanical teething problem, but you have to bear in mind that was the first year that a hovercraft was put into a commercial passenger service for essentially commuting. And that's not a bad statistic to have for something which was, you know, pioneering technology in those days.
And I think that they were run by British Rail, weren't they, effectively, as C-Speed. Is that the right name for it? And yeah. Did they also run one between Southampton and Cowes as well, I think?
Yes, yeah, so C-Speed, and then it became Hoverloid, which became the cross-channel route from Dover to France. And yeah, there's separate stories for that. But yeah, to start with, the hovercraft fell under the strange operating management of British Rail, essentially. You're going from one extreme to the other. I mean, in the 1960s, the last steam engines were still on the road. But yeah, here you've got this peculiar thing, which isn't an aeroplane or a boat, and it's flying and gliding across the surface. Very British, isn't it, really, when you think of it that way?
And how did they get from crossing the Solent to crossing the Channel?
That was the next development, the SRN4. And I think that's really one of the main hovercrafts that a lot of people can relate to, because it was the hovercraft that a certain era of people went on holiday with, while a lot of people were going on cheap Danair flights to wherever in Spain, and package holidays were coming in. This new hovercraft came out, and you could drive your car in one end, fly over to France in half an hour. It was a huge novelty when it came out. The fastest ever recorded crossing is 22 minutes, bearing in mind it travels at 8 feet above the surface. And I can say one story that I heard years ago. There was an occasion, it was pitch black in the night, quite foggy, and the SRN4 had a radar operator on it. They saw this blip on their radar screen. It just happened like really quick. They couldn't avoid it, so they went over this blip, and then I think it was Ramsgate. The pilots were in this bar and they heard these fishermen over talking about something that happened the night before. And they were saying that they heard this howling noise and all of a sudden it just went black. Whatever it was, they were soaked, but they were okay. They didn't know what happened. And they were relaying this story in the bar. And the radar operator looked at one of the pilots and realised, yeah, that was us. The hovercraft flew over them. And you think, oh, well, that's quite astonishing. But a hovercraft has a very low ground pressure, which is why the military love hovercrafts, because they don't tend to detonate mines. But I thought that was an interesting story. And there's also the video on YouTube. So there's this hovercraft in Australia in 1969, and this news reporter just lays down on a beach and says, I want this hovercraft to run over me. And it just runs over him. And you see this film and think, flipping it, you wouldn't do that today with all the health and safety. But he was all right. He didn't say anything after he gets up, but he's got a grin on his face.
And possibly the reporter got up with a slightly less facial hair than he had before. Who knows?
Yeah. I'm sure he had a few beers after that, yeah.
Did you ever go on the really big ones over to the continent? They must have been an amazing thing to ride.
Yeah, it was amazing. You sit on it, lovely comfortable seats, and when it starts up, it's like a Boeing 747. Then all of a sudden, your vision out the window just went, because the skirt inflates, rises above the window. Pressure builds underneath the hull of the hovercraft, and then you rise above the skirt. And all of a sudden it just goes completely smooth, and then you just travel out. Amazing experience to ride the SRN4. That was what they called the Super SRN4 at the time. It was towards the end of its life, where they were extended. Amazing experience. Yeah, it was incredible, really, yeah.
And did they become popular in any other parts of the world? Well, obviously we've got Cross Solent and Cross Channel. Anywhere else take them on board?
Yes, I mean, all over the world, all sorts of countries that you wouldn't necessarily imagine, certainly for delivering aid. Helicopters were more expensive and costly to run than a hovercraft. The hovercraft could potentially go anywhere, and certainly when you look at some of the BP footage of where they funded hovercraft expeditions, they were essentially coming up from rivers and lakes straight into a fuel garage, filling up, and then driving along the road and then straight back out. The hovercraft, although it looked space age, it was a very simple machine to maintain and operate. Obviously skirt segments get worn when you go over ground, but in general the principles of how a hovercraft works is incredibly simple compared to a helicopter.
And a lot less accidents, should we say. And I suppose that the 70s and 80s were pretty much a golden era for the hovercraft, but something changed, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I mean, there was rising costs. People say rising costs of fuel. I mean, that's continuous. I don't really see that as a fair argument. Helicopters were becoming more, I suppose, more cost-effective in some ways, but they weren't really a rival. Catamarans were being developed. However, where hovercraft were born with gas turbine engines, they were expensive to run, and that's aircraft technology in what is essentially a marine environment. The two don't necessarily go together. So in the 1980s, diesel engines became more reliable for this application. The hovercraft in the 1980s was still in operation, the cross-channel one, the one here, and all around the world, you know, Australia, Japan, and obviously don't forget Ranulf Fiennes, who took two hovercraft down the White Nile in 1969, essentially to trace the source of the White Nile. But it was a step to promote the hovercraft. There are all these things going on in the background with hovercrafts. And I think in the 1980s, it's still very much a big thing.
So we don't have many left right now. We've only got the one, as you've mentioned, between Ryde and Southsea. And I think there's one just started again in Japan. But what do you see the future for hovering vehicles of any kind?
It's a good question. A lot of people think that hovercrafts are dead. Well, they're not dead. Japan recently, it was last year, they introduced a new service to go to an airport in the southern region. They're using the same hovercraft we have here, the 12,000 TD. So that in itself, that's a new scheduled hovercraft service. The hovercraft, I think, has got a new life because technology is progressing where they can be made to be more efficient than they were in the 1960s. We don't need to use gas turbine engines. Griffin Hoverworks have an electric version that they're building. But I mean, that's just an example. The hovercraft has so much more potential. It could go into a new age. As operating costs reduce with technology, then it's going to have a new resurgence. And the hovercraft is still as versatile as it was when it came out. On the second note of that, I want to say, for those that have been inspired by things like Back to the Future, and that are growing up in this kind of UFO disclosure world, where we see things that are, what's anti-gravity, what's plasmagnetic levitation, all this new technology which doesn't really require great sources of power, it's a vision of the future. I see potentially development of hovering vehicles to go a different way. Maybe we do tap into some kind of zero-point energy field, this system that doesn't require this form of energy that is not sustainable. I know that sounds kind of stuff of myth and fantasy, but the reality is I do see that people want hovercrafts, people want that wow factor, and people want to be not ripped off anymore. You know, the future is what you make it at the end of the day.
Crikey, I really share your optimism. I hope we do have that one down. I know that you and I could go chatting around about this for quite a lot longer, but we have to draw it to a close, I'm afraid. Thanks so much for explaining the wonderful history of the hovercraft to us. Thanks for joining us, Ashley.
No, thank you very much. I also just want to say a big thank you and acknowledge someone who was really responsible for the history of the hovercraft as we see it today and for preserving history for the hovercraft, and that is Warwick Jacobs, who founded the Hovercraft Museum in Leon Solent.
Go and visit that for sure, and check out Ashley's great book on the subject by searching for Ashley Hollybones, The Hovercraft, A History. Join us next time for chatting more art, transport, communications history on Vectis Radio. But stay tuned for more music after the news.